Thank you. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Smith, Judge Flory, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
And good morning again, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are conducting our proceedings today, October 20th, 2022, on our Zoom platform. I see we do have many people that are observing today as students. Welcome to you. And you're muted, so we can't hear you. So don't worry about us hearing or seeing or doing anything with that. Our main concern is that, of course, the appellant and the respondent counsel can see and hear us clearly. If at any time there's an audio or a picture issue, let us know. I don't see respondent counsel. I saw that you were here, Ms. Bocamp.
Yes, Your Honor. The Zoom window says I cannot start my video because the host has stopped it. All right, let me give it a shot.
Well, good morning. Good morning. And see again, just, you know, when we start out on the wrong foot, it's like that's the way it's going to go from then on. Again, if there's any inability to see or hear, be sure and either send a chat or raise your hand, or if we see that you're not there, we'll go ahead. The rules of court procedure remain intact, despite the fact we're not live in the courtroom. You'll each have 15 minutes to present your case, and there'll be an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal if appellant counsel chooses to use that. When you begin your argument, please state your name and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of. And with that said, I'll ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration.
Calling case number A220839. Kamar Abdul versus WB Limited Partnership.
Do I start? Okay, very well. This is Peter Sandberg, and I'm the attorney who represents the appellant, Kamar Abdul. The theme of my argument is simply stated is leases are contracts. The universal characteristic of all leases that all leases share, whether verbal or written, is a lease is a contract. A landlord and a renter don't bother to define for themselves who's a trespasser or who's an entrant or who's a business invitee. When there's a lease, it's a contract, and the renter is the renter, and the renter is identified by the first name and the last name. Here,
let me interrupt you 1 second, sir, and ask you just a quick question just to clarify the issue.
Yeah.
Do you agree that the only cause of action that was before the district court and now before this court is your breach of contract that was pled in the Fourth Amendment amended complaint?
That is correct. And that's why I say, I mean, the theme to this is just simply this. There is no lease that is not a contract. Stated in the positive, Judge, leases are contract. The universal characteristic they share, all of them share, verbal or written, is a lease is a contract between a landlord and a renter. We don't need to identify if Abdallah was a trespasser, a business invitee, or an entrant. That plays no role when there is a breach of a lease. And I'll get to the lease in just a second. But in this lease, it is treated as a contract, as between the landlord and the renter. And what I'm saying, Judge, is that the court can't treat this lease any differently than what the landlord and the renter, the parties to the contract, treated it. Here, Washington Village and Abdallah had a written lease saying in part as follows, quote, owner is not responsible for any damage or injury that occurs to occupant not caused by the willful or negligent act or admission of the owner. Positively stated, Washington Square is liable for its negligent act or omission causing injury to Abdallah. That's what the written lease says. And all I'm saying, Judge, is that the court is required to follow the contract, unless the contract itself or some term in the contract is contrary to public policy. And I will get to that in just a second. Here is a written lease. It's a contract, and the contract says Washington Square is liable for its negligent act or omission causing injury to Abdali. Now, the third aspect of my brief was this Chapter 504B of the Minnesota Statutes. And what I'm saying there is that incorporated into each lease, verbal or written, whether it is stated or unstated in the lease, are covenants listed in Chapter 504B of the Minnesota Statutes. This is a matter of public policy. And all the appellant is saying here, Judge, is that once again, not only is the court required to follow the contract, but the court is also required to follow public policy. Washington Square's brief doesn't address these covenants. And all I'm saying is that the court cannot just simply ignore these covenants in 504B and just simply move on. Washington Square had a common law contract and statutory duty based on a lease, a contract, to keep the common areas free from snow and ice and warn its renters about the danger. On February 27, 2019, Washington Village shoveled the sidewalks where Kamir Abdali fell but failed to spread sand or salt or scrape the black ice covering the sidewalk, so the sidewalk was reasonably safe for its renters or as a visual cue to warn them that black ice was present. Now, there was a second issue raised in the case that there was no genuine issue of material fact. I devoted a page and a half to the genuine issue of material fact. I really have nothing more to say about it. I don't think I could state it any clearer than what I've stated in those 1.5 pages. Unless there are any questions from the court, this is what my whole appeal is about. The lease is a contract. The court is required to follow it. There are covenants that have been made as a matter of public policy, and those covenants must be followed as well. And insofar as a genuine issue of material fact is concerned, they say they spread sand, salt, and ice melt on the black ice, and my client, Kamir Abdali, is saying they didn't. So with that, I will close. I reserve the balance of my time, and I yield the floor to the defendant unless the court has questions of me. Thank you.
I do have a question, yes. Mr. Sandberg, and you might have explained this, and might be my failure, but can you explain to me, when we're looking at, and I'm looking at your brief. So the lease and the covenants require WV to answer for a breach when its negligence causes damage. So the covenants require negligence in order for there. Can you explain to me the correlation between negligence and the covenants one more time, if you don't mind?
The covenants do not mention negligence. What they say is, what I'm picking up there, for purposes of clarity, Judge, is that in the common law, the common areas, the landlord was required to keep the common areas safe. This contract, the term negligence arises as a matter of contract as specified in the lease. When you move to the covenants, what I'm saying about the covenants is that the covenants make it abundantly clear that common law rule will rule with the common areas, and that whether it is a written contract or a verbal contract makes no difference. Whether the covenants are stated or unstated in a verbal or a written lease is inconsequential. Those covenants are there as a matter of public policy. The legislature has addressed them. They have spoken. And I'm not trying to be dictatorial around here. Don't misunderstand me. But my understanding of the law is that unless there is some unclarity over the public policy, and I don't think that there is any unclarity in this statute, and none has been raised by the respondent, the court, once again, is required to incorporate these covenants into the lease between Abdali and Washington Square and enforce those covenants.
All right. Just for my clarification, what you're saying then is that your client was not required to specifically plead a negligence theory in the Fourth Amendment amended complaint because of the covenants.
Exactly, because basically, again, a lease is a contract. There is no circumstances under which a lease is not a contract. So you're really suing in contract, whether it's common law, contract, or the covenants. A lease has one nature and one nature alone, and that attribute is it's a contract. You're suing on contract.
So it sounds like, Sandberg, it sounds like, though, as I understand your brief and your theory, that still the principles of negligence apply. They're just in a
Oh, sure.
It's the same thing. So in other words, would be summary judgment that's appropriate under a negligence theory, it would also be appropriate under a contract theory, that the principles of negligence are incorporated.
True.
Yeah, into your contract theory, correct?
Yeah. It doesn't, the lease doesn't divest itself of any necessity to challenge a motion for summary judgment on grounds that there needs to be, I don't quite know how to say this, and I'm stumbling, but the shortest way of saying it, the lease between Abdali and Washington Village doesn't abrogate what the court requires when an appellant such as Abdali addresses a motion for summary judgment. But what I am saying is that the whole notion of negligence arises as a matter of contract. That is the reason for which the pleading is done in the form of a contract. This is not a Les Meister situation. This is not a construction contract. This is a lease. And with a lease, and I'm sorry for being redundant here a little bit, but with a lease is always a contract.
And why do you prefer a contract claim to a negligence claim? I mean, contract claim instead of a negligence if they're coextensive effectively?
No, but the negligence claim is embedded in the lease. That's the explicit language of the lease. Like I say,
I appreciate your theory, which is why I'm wondering why you amended your complaint to be only contract and excluded negligence.
To be perfectly frank about it, I like to see things move along in a lawsuit. If there is something that is troubling to the court, I'll try and fix it. But it did not, from the first complaint to the fourth complaint, it never once changed my approach to this action. A lease is a contract. The negligence arises from the terms of the lease itself, and the lease is explicit, deals explicitly with the landlord's negligence. That doesn't mean that
Mr. Sandberg,
are you
positing then that each amended complaint absorbed the prior complaint? Do you get what I'm getting at? So
no,
when you filed your fourth amended complaint, are you saying that incorporated the terms of number 1, 2, and 3?
No, I'm saying that all four complaints are identical in that the element that they share is that it was really an action for a breach of contract. That is when a landlord sues a renter or a renter sues a landlord and a lease is involved. Basically, what we're dealing with here is a contract. The common law rule over common areas really grows out of a contract. It does not grow out of a tort. It is a contract. I'm suing on a lease between the landlord and the tenant that requires the landlord that if he negligently acts or if there is a negligent act or omission by the landlord that injures the renter, he must answer for it. It doesn't.
What are we to do, Mr. Sandberg, with the law that says Minnesota doesn't recognize a negligent breach of contract cause of action?
Because this isn't suing the landlord for a negligent breach of contract. This is suing the landlord to enforce the terms of the contract that if he was negligent, he must answer for his negligence when his negligence, his act or omission, injures his renter.
And the theory is that you're not suing, like in another contract that says you have to pay by X date, there would be no cause of action for negligently failing to pay by X date. But you're saying right. This contract claim, by its nature of incorporating the common law, incorporates a negligence claim. So to be clear, if a claim fails negligence, it would also, if it fails to survive summary judgment on a negligent theory, it would also fail to survive summary judgment on your contract theory. Right?
That is correct. And then again, backing up to Lesmeister. Lesmeister is a construction contract that, it, unlike a lease, specifies the manner in which the work is to be done. There is nothing in a lease that specifies how the landlord does his work. This is not an action for a negligent breach of contract. I agree with what Lesmeister holds, but the court has to remain mindful of the context within which that rule arises in Lesmeister. That is a construction contract, and there is a world of difference between a construction contract and a lease. And there's a whole body of law that surrounds the lease. And I mean, in personal injury, if I can just summarize it here, but there is a whole different body of law that surrounds the relationship between a landlord and tenant and what happens when the renter is hurt or an invitee of the renter is hurt, that has absolutely no application to Lesmeister. Lesmeister does not apply here. That is a construction contract. That isn't a lease. Any other question? Because I've reached the end of my notes.
It appears not. And Mr. Sandberg, you only had five seconds as we're coming down.
Okay. All right. Well, then you get to shut me down once again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll turn to respondent counsel. And you're muted, Jen.
I apologize. Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. May it please the court. My name is Rachel Beauchamp, and I represent the respondent, Washington Village West. I'll refer to them just as Washington Village during this argument. Today, my client is before this court asking the court to affirm the district court's entry of summary judgment and dismissal of all claims with prejudice on two grounds. First, as discussed, the sole issue before this court is a breach of contract claim, which was pled in the fourth amended complaint. And assuming we move past that, and certainly to be argued and has been briefed, the second ground would be that if we are applying a negligence standard to this breach of contract case, or however we define this case, summary judgment remains mandated on the basis of notice. A plaintiff must provide evidence of actual or constructive notice of an alleged defective condition before they can prove a duty. This case lacks that evidence. The sort of third, not specific ground, but kind of the issue that I think floats around in this case is whether there is some unique or different standard that applies as between a landlord and a tenant, other than either one of two things, a lease, which clearly articulates and defines the duties as between the parties, or the common law, which is set forth in case law and the jury instructions. And there is no separate unique standard here. We have two items. We have a lease that sets out clearly articulated duties, and then we have the common law, and that includes the duties described in Section 504B. And I'll move on to that in just a moment. I am going to, from your comments and your questions. I'm going to skip any recital of the facts. It seems like everyone is very up to speed on this case, so I won't waste any time there.
Well, I'm gonna assume, and I'm sorry, I pronounced your name wrong at first go, Beauchamp. I'm presuming that you're relying on Wise versus Stonebridge to support your client's position.
I'm sorry, which one of my client's positions?
The landlord's position. As far as summary judgment, that we don't create a new statutory negligence cause of action under this theory that's been alleged.
Correct. I'm relying on this whole series of cases that plaintiffs cited that involved landlord-tenant claims that discussed the distinction between actions taken on in the lease as contractual duties. And then that there is the negligence standard that applies. So each of those cases, as we went through them, addressed the notice provision. And plaintiff's original opposition to my client's original motion for summary judgment was that notice does not apply in a breach of contract case. And that's simply inaccurate. And every one of the cases cited in our brief, especially the ones about, for example, the children falling out of windows, a horrific fact situation, but it requires notice. And that is the piece, that's the crux of this case. If we get past all of the sort of odd shifting back and forth and is it a contract or is it negligence? The negligence standard, and I'll just start there because that's the meat and potatoes of the case. The negligence standard is the duty of reasonable care. Section 504B does not put any duties on a landlord above and beyond the duty of reasonable care. And if you read it, there's subdivision one, which sets out a few requirements, and they say things like in reasonable repair, fit for use. There's no specific articulated duties. Counsel argued to keep the premises clear of snow and ice. That is not articulated anywhere in the contract. And it's certainly.
Can I ask you, Ms. Beauchamp? So your argument is there is no duty to clear ice and snow. And I presume when I look at what the duties, the definition of the duties were, that they were all in the lease that you cited seemed all related to the apartment itself. Are you saying that the landlord has no contractual duty to do anything with respect to the common areas or the hallway or the shoveling or anything? So there's no breach of contract for a tenant claim if, you know, the moment they step out of their apartment, it's an utter and like impassable disrepair, for example. Like they were just doing it for. Well, are they doing it to avoid negligence actions, or why did they spend their money shoveling them?
Both. So the contract, so there's a couple parts there. I'm going to go through them each. Okay, so the contract does address internal common areas. So there are different types of rental scenarios, right? So you rent a home and your yard is defined by a space. The landlord, the areas of that outside, for example, mowing the lawn, are still part of the area you rent yourself, but the landlord is legally responsible for making sure they meet the code in terms of the city's code for how long the grass can be. So this is an apartment building. So there's internal common areas, and then the external area is a sidewalk open to everyone. It's not an area that's specifically rented. That area is governed by the common law, the duty of reasonable care to keep the property open and, the duty of reasonable care is to keep the property reasonably safe from unreasonably defective conditions. That's the jury instruction. So if you look at 504B, and if you look at rental leases generally, the duty to clear snow and ice can be contracted to the renter. And then you just have to give adequate consideration. In short, it just lays out that the landlord is still the property owner, despite a renter's possession and control of the living area. The property owner owns the property and has that legal duty unless the lease requires otherwise. This lease did not require otherwise. And as a result of owning the property, the Washington Village owed the duty to everyone, to a taxi driver delivering or picking someone up, to a delivery person walking on and off this public area.
They're doing what they're doing in order to fulfill a common law duty, a contractual duty. And what is the response, the argument? Well, that common law duty is incorporated in by covenants of habitability, which are incorporated into every lease, as I understand the argument, unless I'm misunderstanding it. But.
And I think that is the argument he's making, Your Honor. He did not distinguish between Subdivision 1 and Subdivision 2. So Subdivision 1 says in every lease or license of residential premises, the landlord covenants and lays some things out. Subdivision 2 says tenant maintenance, and it talks about that you can contract back and forth as between those. So I am not sold on the argument that it is automatically part of a lease such that breach of contract is the appropriate argument, but I guess I don't think it legally matters because the next step is negligence. And so I guess it would mean that we move on to that negligence argument, but we were ready to do that from day one. And that was the issue. You know, we showed up, we're arguing negligence, and the argument suddenly moved to this Section 19 argument that Section 19 created an affirmative duty under the contract. And the issue with the covenants is that some of them are affirmative, but when they use the term reasonable care, that just means that they're still the property owner. They're still... It's not an affirmative contractual duty. Our brief says a contract or a breach of contract is failure to perform the promise that forms the contract. So if you look through this contract, you'll see articulated like what does and doesn't form the promise that forms the contract. And then we have sort of a group of laws that set out those nebulous areas. What do you do with your outside sidewalk? You live there, you're there every day, it's your home, but they're the property owner. Here we go, 504B says it right there. Property owner still is responsible for using the duty of reasonable care to keep it, you know, whatever the law says about whatever the area is. Here it's winter, snow, and ice conditions. And so in Minnesota, in winter snow, well, in every property slip and fall case, there is a requirement to prove notice. And that notice must be either actual, and there's no such evidence in this case, or constructive. And the only way to prove constructive notice is to provide evidence as to when and how a condition formed. And you can use sideways evidence. I've had cases where people are like, there were tracks frozen into clearly visible ice and banana peels that had been there for a day or two. Here, in this case, we have a sidewalk that looks perfectly clear, that the plaintiff slipped and fell, that she testified she looked very closely at the ground and never saw any ice, that she laid on the ground for 10 minutes and never saw any ice, and that she does not know when or how it formed. And so a jury would be impermissibly speculating that it formed during the snowstorm, that it formed from dripping, that it formed. I mean, I could make a million different ways that ice forms in the winter. You know, people track it in and out. There's lots of different things. And as a result, whether this arises under the common law or inserting the common law into the contract, it is really somewhat irrelevant to our argument. I do not agree legally that this is a breach of contract case. We handle these cases all the time. They are always pled in negligence. And this case was pled in negligence originally. And it was quite a shock to everyone when there was a sudden switch that said notice isn't required. But I think we can see from where the argument is now that argument's not being made anymore. It's simply an argument that negligence is a part of this breach of contract. And the Section 19 carves out negligence from prohibited claims. In other words, we do not disagree that at every stage, Ms. Abdul had a right to bring a negligence claim against the landlord. However, there is nothing specifically articulated in the lease or even in Section 504B that could be matched to any fact alleged in this case and then found to be a breach. As a result, my client moved for summary judgment on the face of the fourth amended complaint. It did not match any facts to any contractual terms. Right there. Next, the legal arguments did not match any facts to any specific duty. I mean, the duty cannot be to stand out there with an umbrella and ensure that no snow or ice ever touches the ground. That's not the duty. The duty is the duty of reasonable care as an owner of property to everyone, to renters, to delivery people, to employees, to people just trying to get to the store to get groceries. Our position is that this case has been sort of messily pled, but as alleged in the fourth amended complaint, there is no breach of contract properly alleged, and we're entitled to summary judgment. And as to the concept of negligence in this case, however we get there, whether it's through one of the earlier complaints or whether it's through the covenants or the carve out in the contract that negligence claims exist, summary judgment remains mandated because there's no evidence as to when or how this condition formed. I want to use my last minute to note each time that plaintiff has argued this case, they've said, well, it's a question of fact whether they salted or sanded. That is not our position. We have never argued we salted and sanded and we're done. The position is that the plaintiff, the claimant, bears the burden of proof of providing admissible evidence as to the length of time the specific alleged defective condition is present. They have not done so, and summary judgment is appropriate. Thank you.
The length of time for purpose. Oh, excuse me. The length of time only because it goes to the question of notice.
Correct.
Anything else, Judge Smith or Flory? Thank you then, Ms. Beauchamp. We'll turn back to Mr. Sandberg for rebuttal of Benny.
Just two things. First of all, yeah, I agree when it comes to a public sidewalk, there is an entirely different body of law that applies to the liability of a private property owner to take care of a public sidewalk. But this is the first time Washington Square has raised an issue over whether or not this is a public sidewalk. It wasn't raised with the trial court. It wasn't raised in their brief. It's being raised for the first time today. Or
I'm not sure that was what was. I thought that it's the landlord's sidewalk and the landlord. It's the property owner's sidewalk and the property owner has a duty to everyone who would use that, including the public in the common law, that's why the landlord keeps it clear because they have a common law duty to everyone. No, I'm not sure it meant that it was a public, you know, city sidewalk, because I assume it was that the sidewalk is the property owner's sidewalk in this case. Like we know.
No, Judge, I think she's going one step further. She's trying to say that if this is just the landlord's sidewalk, he can do whatever he wants with that sidewalk. This, throughout this litigation, this has been treated as a common area. It is not being treated as a public sidewalk. I agree. There is a body of law that is entirely different when it comes to a public sidewalk that doesn't equate well with a common area. But with the lower court and with this court and in its brief, it treated this sidewalk as a sidewalk that constituted a common area. I'm just calling that to your attention. There has been no mention or claim made by the defendant that this was a public sidewalk. The last point I want to make is on the matter of notice. It seems fairly simple to me. They went out there, they shoveled the sidewalks. Notice, they were out there shoveling the sidewalks. They were taking care of the common areas. They say that they spread sand, salt, and ice melt on the sidewalks and offered the court the proof that they had done so. We aren't dealing with notice here. what's the issue, the genuine issue of fact comes to rest with the fact that Mrs. Abdallah says it was black ice. There was no sand, salt, or else ice melt on it. What we're saying is that they failed to take the last step. After shoveling away the snow, they didn't apply sand, salt, and ice melt to this area. Maybe not that it would have, maybe not to show, awkward way of saying this, I apologize, not to show that that would have eliminated the ice, but it would be a visual cue to a renter or a tenant as to the existence of black ice. I don't see that notice really has much of anything to do with this litigation. They shoveled it. They say they spread sand, salt, and ice melt, and they want to say that this little piece of paper that was written down that doesn't specify where they did it should be treated as conclusive evidence of the fact that that area was sanded, salted, and ice melt applied. That's what we say is the genuine issue of material fact. That's why we say notice is a red herring. Thank you. I have nothing further unless the court itself has questions.
It appears there's no further questions.